We're in Baba Metzia. We're continuing our special class on the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the great, great sage, the Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva, and the rabbis ruling where they put him in halachic ostracism as he argued against them, proved his point in all kinds of spiritual ways, but ultimately, the rabbis did not see eye to eye with him from the basic halachic perspective, and because he maintained his position, they ostracized him, even though there was no high court at the time. This is after the destruction of the temple. This is taking place when you don't have a high court sitting in the temple, so there's no such thing as the rebellious elder, but nonetheless, there has to be a system. And if the rabbis come to account and they all disagree with him, So he was supposed to give in, and he didn't. On the contrary, he kept bringing proofs why he was right. And not proofs from the Torah or Talmud, but proofs from spiritual miracles, so to speak. And we had discussed that Rabbi Eliezer was very pained. And the Gemara actually brings the story in reference to the prohibition of Ona'at Devarim, saying something that will hurt someone else's feelings. So, Ona'ah is affliction. There's Ona'at Mamon, that means you're afflicting someone in money, when you're not dealing fairly, and Ona'at Devarim, when you afflict someone verbally. So, Rabbi Eliezer was married to Rabban Gamliel's sister. It's another phenomenal thing. Here he is, a chozer b'tshuva, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and he marries into the greatest family of Israel, you see? He marries into the family of the Davidic dynasty, the family of the Nasi. So we said that when they put Rabbi Eliezer in Shamta or Cherem or Nidur, whatever it was, Rabbi Gamliel's life was endangered. He almost drowned at sea. So Rabbi Gamliel's sister, who was Rabbi Eliezer's wife, from that day onward, she would never let him say Tachanun. Every time he would finish his Shmoneh Esrei and he'd want to say Tachanun, she'd come and ask him a question. She'd distract him. So he didn't go straight from Shmoneh Esrei to Tachanun. One day it was Rosh Chodesh. And she thought it was 2 days Rosh Chodesh. And she didn't realize that it was one day Rosh Chodesh. They didn't have calendars hanging on the wall, so she thought he's not saying Tachanun today. Or a different version of the story says that he was finishing his Shmoneh Esrei when a poor man was detaining her at the door. And as she was giving him bread, she sees Rabbi Eliezer doing Tachanun, putting his head down in prayer. Now what do we say when we put our head down in prayer? Tsar li me'od, Ribono shel Olam, look at how I'm suffering. I put myself in your hands. That's what she didn't want him to say. And that one day, she missed. And she runs into the room. And she says, get up. She doesn't have an excuse now. She says, get up, you're killing my brother. But before he could get up, they were blowing the shofar from down the block from Rabbi Gamliel's house, which was a sign that the Nasi was found dead. He had dropped dead that morning. Wow. And he looked at her, and he basically said, how'd you know? Which was another way of saying, I didn't pray he should drop dead. I was just expressing my pain. How did you know this would happen? And she says to him, I have a tradition from David, from my great-great-great-grandfather, David HaMelech, that all gates can be closed in heaven, other than the gate of Ona'ah, someone who hurts someone else's feelings, so then that's a cry that is always heard in heaven. And so I knew that if you come down and say Tsar li me'od, I knew that that endangers my brother. Even though technically, halachically, the rabbi sided with Rabbi Gamliel. We already know what we saw in Avot Rabbi Natan, that when Rabbi Eliezer passed, the rabbis actually seem to have taken back their stance. It seems that they realized they were in error. So that's the story that we have over here. We did almost all the Gemara, and maybe we should do a few more lines, even though most of the people in this classroom are in the gear process. So it's not so nogea them to know, it's nogea everyone else to know. Okay, you should know anyways. The Braisa says, if someone says something hurtful to a ger, so he is in greater transgression than if he says it to a Jew, to a person who was born Jewish. He transgresses three prohibitions. And if someone oppresses him, he transgresses two. It says, ger lo toneh, right? It says, lo tonu oto, don't afflict him. And it says, lo tonu ishetamito. First of all, he has the baseline prohibition. It says, don't afflict your fellow man. So ger is included in that. So number one, you're not allowed to afflict him because he's part of Am Yisrael. But the Torah gives two more prohibitions. The Torah says, ger lo toneh. And it says, lo tonu oto, when you have a ger in your midst, don't afflict him. So even though a regular Jew has one prohibition, the ger, we have two more prohibitions warning us not to say something hurtful to a ger. So we have triple the prohibition. We have to be thrice as careful. The Gemara then says, Rabbi Eliezer says, why is it that there are 36 places in the Torah that the Torah warns us to treat the ger nicely? Because the ger always has it harder. Because the ger always knows, I came from there, and there's always that temptation to go back there. He has a temptation that other people don't have. So if someone else has a bad day, they might not wake up for a minyan. But when someone has a bad day, and they know they have an option of getting a plane ticket back to Salt Lake City, Utah, so I don't know where you're from. I'm saying Salt Lake City, Utah, because that's where one of our students went. that's where one of our students got up and left. He had a difficult marriage and wasn't married that long. When things got tough, he got up, bought a plane ticket, flew back to Salt Lake City, Utah. It's hard. It's hard. It's a bigger challenge. So the Torah warns us 36 times. Be careful to treat him nicely. So that's the final tips we have here in this sugiyah. So that's the story of Onat Tevarim. That's the story of Rabbi Eliezer. Now that we finished the story, there was a very big rabbi in the United States, came from Europe. His name was Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin. Before Rabbi Feinstein came to the United States, he was considered the big halachic authority in New York. He headed an organization called Ezrat Torah. And just so we have a picture of his greatness, when he was a youngster, so he traveled to Mir to learn in the yeshiva. He crossed Europe to learn in Mir. And when he came to the yeshiva, so the winter was just starting. They tested him, and they said to him, you're not accepted. You're not up to par. It was winter, and he could not make the journey back home. It was no longer possible to travel back home. So he went to the shul next to the yeshiva and sat there and learned. Don't ask me what he ate or where he slept. Maybe he slept in shul, I don't know. But he stayed there all winter. He wasn't accepted to the yeshiva. He stayed in the shul and learned tractate Erevin. He was on his way back when spring came, so now he could travel back home. And he came by a Beit Midrash where Rav Chaim of Volozhin was learning. And another great luminary of the time, they were having an argument of some halacha in the laws of Erevin. So he's sitting in the back of the shul. He just learned Erevin all winter long. Reviewed it 40 times that winter. Wow. And they're arguing back and forth. And this one brings a proof this way. Another one brings proof that way. And after listening to their arguments, he walks over and says, can I make a suggestion? So they say, fine. And he opens up a Tosefta and Erevin. And he brings them proof that neither one had thought of. And they both agreed that his proof was better than theirs. When he came to the United States, so Rav Pesen Zatzal, who I had the good fortune to learn by, learned by him. And he asked him if he could get smicha from him, if he could get rabbinic ordination from him. So Rav Henkin said, fine. In order to enter the test, this wasn't the test, this was the prelude to the test. In order to enter the test for smicha by Rav Henkin, Rav Pesen told me, Rav Henkin told him, you prepare and come to me, and I'll ask you a question, and you have to tell me in which chapter of Shulchan Aruch, based on chapter numbers, the answer is. Wow. And that's before the test. You want to enter the test for rabbinics by me, so I'll ask a question, you have to say which siman, which chapter the answer is. And that's before you can be tested. When did I get to hear this from Rav Pesen? When I asked Rav Pesen for smicha. So he said to me, well, when I went to get my smicha, that was the intro. So if you want to talk to me about smicha, that's the level I need to work on. So I never got smicha from him. I wasn't there. But so that's Rav Henkin. So after that introduction, Rav Henkin said the following about this Gemara. Rav Henkin says, why did the rabbis give a nickname to this oven? Why did they call the oven of the snake? Tanur Shalachnai.
Yeah, but you mentioned, you explained it, it's filled up with rings and right. Sand and different steps and so on.
So that's the simple reading, yeah. Right. Simple reading is because it looks like a snake. Rav Henkin writes that we say that between Pesach and Shavuos, Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 pairs of students. How did so many students die in such a short time? And so Rav Henkin suggests that the discussion about whether this oven was pure or defiled was actually a discussion about how to view the snake of the time, which was the Roman Empire. And the rabbis were not free to write about it in the Talmud because they were under the Roman rule still at the time when they were writing this. So the rabbis encoded it. And they said we had a massive argument about how to treat that oven that's a snake. He goes into why it's called an oven and why it's called a snake. And he says, in fact, there was a discussion how to view the Roman Empire. And when the rabbis disagreed with Rabbi Eliezer, what they said is, all of us agree that the empire is defiled, and we have to fight them. We have to be a part of the rebellion against them. And Rabbi Eliezer said, no, you have to work with them. The oven is pure. There's what to work with. It's a system. The system doesn't, it's not that the system is anti-Jewish or pro-Jewish or pro-pagan. They're going to let us work. There's a democracy there. You can work within that system, and we can thrive as a Jewish people under that system. We don't have to look at it as completely defiled. Very similar to the conversation that takes place two generations later with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Eloi.
And today,
okay. And that's what he said, that when Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 pairs of students, those were the students that fought with Bar Kokhba. Rav Henkin writes, the rabbis couldn't write that in Talmud because they couldn't acknowledge that the rabbinic authorities had taken a side against the Roman Empire. So they couldn't say it openly. They were being persecuted as it is. Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death, literally.
Yeah, yeah.
So the rabbis hid it in this code. And in the end, the rabbis come back to Rabbi Eliezer and say, you were right. Rabbi Akiva comes in after he lost all his students. They were all killed at war. And what? So that's how Rav Henkin interprets it as a piece, explaining this whole piece, this whole section in Talmud, saying that that's really what the discussion was all about. So that's Rav Henkin, his commentary. That's what he writes. So... I would add one more point that's interesting, and I'm not sure if it comes from the same source. My tradition, I'm not saying that's what other people say, but Rabbi Feinstein used to say that a rabbi should encourage all his students to vote. Everyone should vote. You can affect the future of the people. Vote. And a rabbi should not take a stance about who you should vote for. A rabbi can tell you, look, you should look for these values. These should be the guiding principles based on how you choose based on these principles you choose a candidate. But he should not say, vote for so-and-so. He should just say, everyone has to vote, and I'm not saying who you should vote for. And if you think of the story of what happened with the Roman Empire, so then maybe part of it stems from our history of the price we paid for taking sides. You see that when, even though it's hard to compare, because back then it was questions of maintaining the Jewish religion or not, maintaining observancy or not. You know, the Roman Empire was prohibiting circumcision. The Roman Empire was prohibiting keeping Shabbos, yeah. Teaching Torah. So it's hard to compare, but okay.